Well, I think that in all the various countries, there have always been major struggles. Sometimes they had to do with struggles around international trade and against the transnational corporations that were impacting negatively on these different countries. And I would say that the struggle against transnational corporations, for instance, has been going on for a long time. I would say that, you know, in the 1970s and 1980s. But I think that the current movement against globalization was born, the current movement in its current shape, was really born as a reaction to the 1994-1995 ratification of the World Trade Organization, of the Uruguay Round. So I think that there was a sense here that the transnational corporations were the forces behind the Uruguay Round and the creation of a global set of rules that were anti-people and pro-TNCs. And therefore, there was this sense that opposition could no longer just be conducted on a national level, or different oppositions just fighting transnationals in their countries, but the sense that with the WTO and the global framework that it brought about, you now needed to have forces linking hands across the world to be able to oppose the WTO, the rules being imposed by the WTO. So I would say that the catalyst of the current movement was the coming to birth of the World Trade Organization in 1995. And what has happened, of course, since then is that the struggles against the World Bank, the struggles against the IMF, also began to be put within the wider global context. You were no longer just struggling within your countries with minimal coordination from others. But now you were struggling as movements coordinating beyond borders to stop these international institutions. So I would say that there was the movement was born in its current shape in response to the World Trade Organization. The movement then also took on the multilateral agreement on investments and killed it, then moved to take on the IMF and the World Bank. I think that the transnational corporations themselves as institutions will soon also become a major target of this transnational people's movement. So that, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the TNC itself, no longer just the WTO, no longer just the World Bank, no longer just the IMF, but what people perceive as the central force dictating globalization, the transnational corporation, is going to become increasingly a major target of this movement. I think that this movement has been very critical in terms of reversing the tide in this process. Of course, the structures of globalization are very strong, but I think that what we've had, especially since Seattle, has been a coming together of the movement and in fairly important battles, Seattle in December of 1999, Washington during the IMF World Bank meeting in April, Chiang Mai during the ADB meeting in May of last year, Prague during the IMF World Bank meeting. Basically what you had was forces from all over the world coming together in this anti-globalization movement to be able, you know, to oppose and stand up to and shake these major institutions, so that one of the proponents of globalization, an economist, an American economist named C. Fred Bergsten, now says that the pro-globalization forces have lost the ascendancy to the anti-globalization forces. But what I think the important achievement of this movement is that it has managed to create a crisis of legitimacy for the World Trade Organization, for the IMF, for the World Bank, for many of the multilateral development institutions. And as we all know, if you have a crisis of legitimacy and you cannot reverse it, then it's only going to be a matter of time before the structures themselves begin to erode. So I think right now, these institutions have a major crisis of legitimacy, and this is why this whole Davos meeting is taking place in Switzerland, because this is a place where the elites regroup, rethink their strategies on how can they regain a legitimacy for corporate-driven globalization. So the importance then of Porto Alegre is precisely is that it comes after a year of victories for the movement. And it comes at a very critical time. Now, either Porto Alegre helps us spring forward, or it doesn't. And it all depends on what happens here. This is very decisive. A lot of people came here hoping that this would provide a forum for creating a strategy for the next stage in the struggle. They didn't just come here to exchange ideas. You can exchange ideas about the horrors of globalization anytime. I mean, I certainly came here from Asia because I thought that this is the next step. I think it is important for Porto Alegre to decide two things. One is the strategy of resistance, and one is the strategy of articulating the alternative. The strategy of resistance is very clear at this point. We have to find a way to destroy any efforts by the G7 countries to launch a new trade round. As we all know, the ministerial of the World Trade Organization will be taking place in November in the desert kingdom of Qatar, where there will be no protesters available, because we all know that Qatar is a monarchy and that there will be highly militarized sort of situation. But nevertheless, I think it will be very important that that ministerial does not come up with the agenda of a new trade round. Because if there's an agenda of a new trade round, you now give life to the World Trade Organization. So that's going to be very important. And that's going to be a very important step in making and weakening the World Trade Organization, because I think there is now a sense that the World Trade Organization has gone too far. Either we need to push it back, we need to weaken it. Some of us feel that it's really necessary to disempower it at this point. So the strategy of resistance. We also should be planning as to how do we weaken the World Bank and the IMF. Maybe we can even get to a situation whereby there is a crisis within the global elites because of the very poor record of the World Bank and the IMF, that they could begin to discuss the possibility, with a lot of pressure from the mass movements, of closing down these two institutions. Okay? The third thing that we really need to do in terms of the strategy of resistance is the ability to be able to bring the struggle forward to opposing the structures and the practices of the transnational corporations themselves. Let me just say here that more and more of the behavior of TNCs is criminal behavior. The only way that TNCs can move to be able to achieve their objectives at this point is to engage in criminal behavior, whether it's Shell, whether it is Nike. We find consistent violations of labor rights, human rights, and even outright criminal behavior. Increasingly, people feel that the problem in their lives is the very strong presence of TNCs. So a strategy of resistance with respect to the WTO, the IMF and the World Bank, and the transnational organizations, the transnational corporations. And then what Porto Alegre also needs to do is articulating the alternative. We ought to be coming together here to forge our common principles and our common values that say community solidarity, equity, justice, all of these are more important than market efficiency. Okay? And that because of this, you know, market efficiency should be mainly a tool, you know, and not the end of itself. That's one thing. The second thing is that we should be saying that having shared these values, we also value diversity. And that the way that we create a strategy, the way that we operationalize our values of the good society may differ from one country to another. So that in opposition to the World Bank IMF method of having one model for all, one shoe fits all, we're basically saying we have a common set of principles, but the way we operationalize them is very diverse. It's going to be plural. And then what we then need to do is to deepen the discussions of how we can create domestic economies, you know, that are more oriented to achieving our values, and the sort of international economic system that will support the flourishing of self-oriented, inner-directed domestic economies, where the principle of subsidiarity, meaning that you have nations or communities produce the goods that they need if they can produce those goods without too much problems, you know, the principle of subsidiarity, you know. So basically, therefore, Porto Alegre has to do both. If Porto Alegre just talks about the alternative without talking about the resistance, this is not going to lead anywhere. It will just mean that we're talking in a dream. If Porto Alegre just talks about the resistance and does not talk about the alternative, then unless we have a vision, that resistance, the strategy for that resistance could go off in all sorts of different directions, anarchistic directions. So these two things have to go together in Porto Alegre at this point, which is why it is very important that we come away from Porto Alegre, not just feeling good that we exchange ideas, but also that at least we have come together to forge a common framework and a common strategy for both the short term and the long term. So I would say that this is the significance of Porto Alegre. Now, will Porto Alegre achieve this? I don't know. You know? I don't know.
It all depends. Not yet.
It all depends on how bold we and the organizers are. Okay? If we want to go beyond just talking and formulating a strategy, I think we can do it. But I have to see within the next few days if indeed this is the direction where this will be going. The way that the domestic economy is organized is probably the central question here. And I think that the domestic economy should mainly be organized to fulfill the needs of the domestic market, of the people within, rather than being principal and export-oriented globalized economy. I mean, that's one thing. I mean, there's very different principles here. Under the globalization paradigm, the whole idea is that that domestic economy becomes integrally part of a global economy. There are no more walls. And if people produce for the domestic market, fine. But if they produce for the external market, that's fine too. It all depends on what is best for the market. This is the idea. Okay? Here, in the alternative, we're basically saying, no, we need to orient production for the domestic and the national market and for our communities. And that production for the international community, production for export, is important, but it's a very secondary feature. The second thing that we really need to do is that the resources for development should be coming not principally from international capital markets. We should be raising those ourselves within the domestic market. Now, how do we do that? Well, there's a lot of wealth within these countries. It's just that this wealth is unequally distributed. So we need to have fairly effective systems of taxation. I mean, it is criminal how much third world elites get away with in terms of being able to put their money in foreign banks and the way that their taxes, they hardly pay any taxes at all, whereas it's the common people that pay the taxes through indirect taxes. Okay, the second thing is that there has to be more effective asset distribution, and which means really land reform in these countries. Okay, and the third thing is really you need more systems of income redistribution through various mechanisms. Okay, whether it's social security payments, all of this is very important. Now, the reason that this is very important is that you need to create, one, a base for your resources from which you can draw investment. Okay? And two, you really need a dynamic market of consumers, of people who can effectively be part of the market because they have demand. Okay? And so what this does, therefore, is that social redistribution and economic dynamism are really part of the same pattern. Okay, the third thing that we really need to look at is no longer to put the emphasis on high growth strategies, because high growth strategies, you know, have been terribly, terribly negative for the environment. Okay, and we really need to look at growth strategies that have a very good relationship and impact on the environment, which means really low growth strategies. Now, if you have strategies that focus on income redistribution, on fulfilling people's needs, okay, on the domestic market, then I think that you have economic strategies that can be implemented with low economic growth or non-destabilizing economic growth. The only reason that you've had this 6 to 10% growth rates that were regarded as ideal is because the elite wanted to corner a lot of that growth and still allow a little to pour in to people below. Okay?
Maybe it's then better to talk about real economic growth.
Yes, we're talking about real economic growth. You know, so high economic growth really was a biased elite economic growth so that the elite could corner a large part of that growth and still allow some to trickle down to pacify the people. Okay, so in this strategy, you will now have an economy that is more oriented towards stable, you know, sort of development rather than destabilizing high rate economic growth. It's also going to be important here to have a strategy that is consciously pushing the implementation of the principle of subsidiarity. That is, basically, in politics, we say that the lower the body, okay, you know, the better, you know, to execute decisions. Now, in economics, why do we then change that to the opposite when they say that, you know, we should have the same principle? If communities can produce the goods, okay, within reasonable costs, then they should produce those goods, okay? And that way we will really have effective local live communities instead of having this division of labor that kills communities and that kills people. So that is the priority on the domestic economy. However, to be able to effectively put this into being, you also need a very good international system of economic governance. Okay? Now, a system of economic governance, I think, should be one in which there are broad rules of trade. Okay? Broad rules. There are broad rules on both trade and finance. Okay? But basically, one in which we don't have monolithic organizations like the IMF, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization sort of having this monolithic set of rules that constrain countries. We've got to have a more pluralistic system of economic governance where you have institutions like the ILO, you have regional economic unions, you have multilateral environmental agreements, where all of these institutions and agreements, you know, form a pluralistic net of checks and balances, okay? So that in these systems of checks and balances, there's a lot more space by which countries can maneuver to be able to pursue their particular development paths, okay? So that I'm talking about replacing the system, the monolithic system of governance, which I would call Jurassic, because it belongs to the old IBM Soviet style from the center. Replace that with a fuller play of check and balances among different institutions. On the one hand, you reduce the powers of the IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO. And on the other hand, you try to strengthen the International Labor Organization, the World Health Organization, the United Conference on Trade and Development, regional economic groupings. So basically, we're talking about more space, more areas of maneuver for the different countries, you know, to be able to follow the strategies of their choice, rather than being constrained to follow one model of structural adjustment. Okay, so I think that's going to be very important. So that let me just say and add here that in such a system, I think that although you would have economies that are oriented towards income redistribution domestically, there still has to be international income redistribution. Okay, I think that it would be very important within this system of negotiations, you know, happening globally, these checks and balances type of systems, that an international change in income redistribution and consumption happens, okay? So that in this system, it would really be important to continue to articulate the fact that the main adjustment, economic and ecological adjustment, needs to be done by the North. You know, I mean, that's really needs to be emphasized at this point in time.
Maybe to end, what should be asked first? What's your definition of globalization? Or what's wrong with it then?
Well, globalization is really a process in which the national economies are being integrated. Production systems are being integrated so that when it comes to the question of production and because of that trade, national borders are no longer meaningful. So that what we really see is that the integration of the different national economies, you know, into one global system. And I find this a very disturbing trend, because what happens here is that, you know, those mechanisms, those measures, you know, those borders that allowed the domestic economy to be sheltered to some degree from the volatility of the global economy, to be sheltered from the negative income distributionist effects of a global economy driven by transnational corporations, to be sheltered from the other negative impacts, you know, of this globalized economy, those disappear. And I would say that this integration of production structures, okay, that makes national economic borders irrelevant, is mainly driven by the needs of transnational corporations. Now, this is going very far at this point, okay? But what really needs to be done is that people are becoming conscious of the ways that globalization brings about dependence, loss of national sovereignty, loss of decision-making by the national community, loss of democracy. And so what we're beginning to find out is that people are beginning to say, we really have to disintegrate again, move away from this level of tremendous global dependence. In other words, people are beginning to say that there has to be deglobalization that must take place. Now, that's not withdrawal from the international economy. It would be crazy to withdraw from the international economy. Deglobalization merely means that you have a more healthy balance between your economy and the international economy because you have protections, mechanisms that buffer your economy from the volatility of the global economy and the negative impacts, including in terms of income distribution, of a global economy driven by transnational corporations.
You're talking about a deglobalization in the economical field. To reach that, I suppose we need more global political power. Or how do we organize the human beings, the societies? How do you organize, how do we get there, and how do we gain the power to counterbalance that economical...
I think definitely that precisely the globalization movement is a global movement, but it is a global movement that is trying, in fact, to counter the globalization of economic structures and the globalization of political structures that has come with this. Because when you talk about globalization, it is not only TNC-driven globalization, it is US-driven globalization. Economically, politically, and military, the main beneficiaries are US institutions. Okay, so the anti-globalization movement, interestingly enough, is a real cooperative global movement that is trying to bring back the energies, bring back the vitality, bring back the decision-making power of national polities. Okay? So paradoxically, you know, to regain the respect of the local, to regain the respect for the national and the local, we need to participate in this global movement against corporate-driven globalization. So that's very important. The other thing I would like to say here is that this anti-globalization movement is extremely positive because of the way that it has united civil society organizations across the board. Okay? So what you're seeing here is that by bringing about a new respect for the local and the global, this movement is really creating the basis for a real international community. A real international community in which communities, countries respect one another because there's a more healthy relationship among them. Okay? And I think that a new internationalism is being born by this movement that is opposing corporate-driven globalization. You know, so I would make a distinction between globalization or globalism and internationalism. Internationalism is the sort of society of equals, country equals, you know, that nation-state equals even, you know, that you know, we aspire for. Globalization in which nations and governments become irrelevant or weak and are bound together mainly by the structures forged by transnational corporation. That is globalization. That's not internationalism. That is not internationalization. Now, what we do best is precisely, as I said earlier, we have to forge both the short-term and the long-term strategy of resistance, and we have to forge the alternative strategy of development, or you know, which I talked about earlier. So those two need to go together. And I think we need to be able to fill out the operational strategies, because some of it will mean competing for political power in our countries, to support parties that support the agenda of agrarian reform, support the agenda of an economy that is less globalized, and throw out parties, throw out political parties that have sold their countries to the corporations. So I think that part of the strategy will be movements like us, people who value, a more sane and healthy economic development strategy coming to power. So I would, that's one aspect of it. The other thing that we really need to do is, maybe we need to get together. It would be very important to forge at a regional level really effective economic cooperation bodies, not sort of FTAAs. We're not talking about these free trade type areas that are really just another way of creating a WTO in the end. We're really talking about regional economic bodies. Extent there are elements of the European Union here in terms of the way that countries come together to subordinate their trade, financial, and other strategies to a common sort of European direction. I think there's positive elements of the European Union that we can learn in the third world. We're talking about such bodies whereby cooperation takes place and not just trade liberalization. Technology cooperation for sustainable development, technology sharing, income redistribution taking place at a regional level. I think we really need those two, so that we're not just talking now about just national national reform strategies, but we're really talking about regionalization happening in places like Latin America, in Asia. Progressive regionalization, in which non-governmental organizations and civil society plays a very key role, and not just political parties, not just governments, not just private sector entities in this case. The problem with the European Union that we should not repeat is that this process was brought about mainly by technocrats. It was not subject in many of its aspects to popular sort of surveillance, and a lot of it was also driven by the needs of European corporations. So if we're going to do our own forms of regional integration, it will be a very democratic process. So I think that these are some of the lessons, these are some of the strategies that Davos can help, Porto Alegre can facilitate this sort of discussions taking place.